From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As accusations of Russian meddling in the U.S. 2016 election and claims of Russian aggression are spread wall-to-wall across the U.S. media, we spoke with Dmitry Babich, a journalist with the Russian news agency Sputnik, about a recent column of his that deals with U.S.-Russian relations and the history of U.S.-Russian relations. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Thursday. Dmitry, it's a pleasure to have you back. It's been too long.
Yes, nice to hear from you.
In your column entitled Democracies, Where Are Democracies?, you give a very interesting personal view, basically, of how you came up and your worldview and how it's been changing and where it's at now in relation to what's happening now. You want to talk about the piece a little bit?
Yes, I think that's an interesting subject, and that article was important for me because I needed to sort of explain myself. Usually, unfortunately, there are like two primitive views of what you can think about the previous state of U.S.-Russia relations and Russia's relations with the world in general. There is a primitive view that everything that was done during the Soviet Union is good, and the Americans are bad, so you are just an old communist, maybe slightly reformed, or everything the United States has been doing and is doing is good, and the Soviet Union was awful, so then you must be with the liberals. And I don't want to choose out of these two alternatives. They are both wrong. I think the reality is much more complicated and interesting. And in that article, I tried to explain myself.
Yeah, you know, I think to explain to the audience, because and my perspective also has evolved, I'd say, you know, the evolution is change. Change is the order of the universe, really. But I'll take a Marxist concept, or in any event, a concept that Marx adopted and modified, and that is of the dialectic, a thesis, an antithesis, and a synthesis, to sort of apply that to what's happened both materially and also ideologically in the former Soviet Union, also in the United States, and also around the world as things have unfolded. I told you earlier, I was in Leningrad at a university in 1990 and heard a lecture from a staff member who was older. I assume that he was tenured, and I don't remember for sure, but you know that he was pretty much part of the the university staff. I was shocked at how much his ideological perspective, or his apparent ideological perspective, was based on a Western narrative of democracy, all these things that seemed oppositional to what I had been taught about the ideology that existed in the Soviet Union. And you were, at that point in time, old enough to be a student in that class. And so,
exactly. That's part of my biography. Yeah. I held similar views then.
Maybe let's start there, and you could say what you talk about how in 1986 you saw Margaret Thatcher with three Soviet journalists on TV. You would have been 16 years old then. Maybe we could start there, and you could talk about how what you've seen has evolved.
Well, I'm mentioning that episode in 1986. That was the first full uncensored interview of a Western head of state to Soviet television. And what was Soviet television? When you were on Soviet television, you were talking to the whole nation.
Right.
Because there were just two or three channels.
Right.
So Mrs. Thatcher was then talking to the whole nation. And she made a good impression because people have not been used to these sort of interviews. And I remember what was important was not just even my perception, but it was the perception of a huge majority of the viewers. They were all sort of impressed by Thatcher, and they all disdained the three Soviet journalists who were trying to ask her prickly questions. But, you know, talking about the reason why I'm not a great fan of the classical Soviet Union, I'm not talking about Gorbachev's times, I'm talking about the Soviet Union, especially of 1940s, 1950s. Well, why I'm not a great fan of that epoch? Because I have my own theory. I think that in the 20th century, we had three new secular ideologies sort of driven to the extreme. Christianity was replaced gradually in Europe, and Russia, I think, is a part of Europe, and in the other Western countries, it was replaced by three ideologies. First, it was nationalism, and socialism, and liberalism. So they coexisted, and they were all driven to extremes at various points. Nationalism was driven to extreme in Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, and it was awful. Socialism was primitivized and driven to extreme in the early Soviet Union. I think that already the Soviet Union of 1970s, 1980s was a different story, but in the early Soviet Union, it was also, life was very hard, and indeed a lot of people suffered, even though it helped us to win the war against Nazism. And now we are seeing liberalism showing all signs of being driven to the extreme and becoming a sort of, you know, donning a sort of radical version of itself, which is not much better than the radical version of nationalism or the radical version of socialism. We see the people who call themselves liberals becoming very intolerant, trying to control the press, trying to smash other opinions, actually becoming what a British historian, Jeff Roberts, calls jihadi liberals, forming a sort of a cult of what they call market economy, rule of law, and elections. And becoming jihadi liberals, they're as hostile to classical liberals as the jihadi Muslims are hostile to traditional Muslims. And you see how very quickly these people, I mean the radical liberals or the ultra-liberals, call it whatever you want, they become extremely cruel. You know, if the Nazis removed the nations that they thought were an impediment for their project, if the Soviet Union in Stalin's times removed their hostile classes, the modern so-called ultra-liberals, they're removing whole groups of people which they consider to be hostile to their global projects. Look at what happens in Donbass, look at what happened in the former Yugoslavia, look at what's going on in Syria or in Iraq. If a certain group of people, for example, the Russian-speaking population of eastern Ukraine, if they consider these people an impediment, they are ready either to destroy these people themselves, as they did in Yugoslavia, or they are ready to let another aggressive group, for example, Ukrainian nationalists in the case of Ukraine, to destroy that impediment, to destroy that hostile group. And the ultra-liberals, they have all the perks, all the elements of extremist radical ideology. They consider themselves the end of history, you know,
right,
despite the fact that the theory of Francis Fukuyama revealed itself to be basically a flop,
right,
scientific point of view,
right,
for its believers. It's not a flop. They still believe in it, just like the religious Christian fanatics continued with Inquisition despite Galileo's discoveries,
right,
or despite the fact that Champignon in Egypt found out that the human civilization was actually much older,
right,
than the 5,000 years given to it by the Christian theology.
Right.
So this is the sign of all radical ideologies. Facts do not exist for them. Science does not exist for them unless it serves their plans. So the modern ultra-liberalism is becoming very anti-scientific. It ignores the facts that do not fit their agenda. It is prepared to destroy whole groups of people which are on the way. And it believes in the end of history, in a kind of paradise where people will live if they just have their way and assume the global leadership, as they call it.
You know, it's an interesting ideology, particularly this one in its radical form, using your thesis, because it commodifies all the other ideologies and weaponizes them. For example, fascism is part of its arsenal that it threw at Eastern Ukraine. They put fascists in power, in essence, in Kiev and directed them with their natural instincts, with this hyper-nationalist ideology, at the East and also at Russia. So they even though it's antithetical, supposedly, as an ideology to fascism, it commodifies and employs it as a weapon where it's appropriate to further its game, further its aims. I'm going to go to a crude form of Marxism here, looking past the class analysis, just at raw economics. The concept of totalitarianism was applied to descriptions of the Soviet state. That there was a ruling group, a class, whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had some folks that were calling it new class, where there was a concentration of economic and political power in the hands of a small group of people. Also included control of the media. But here in the United States, in the West, at this point in time, the power over the economy, over the politics as a consequence of the power over the economy and the ownership of the media by a small group of people is a totalitarianism in a way. In fact, that the Soviets could have only envied at that time because of the technology available and the pervasiveness of Western economic power and culture.
You're absolutely right. And in general, I think that this concept of totalitarianism, it is wrong in a way, because the Soviet Union under Stalin and Nazi Germany, they were not twins. If you look closer, even the American historians like Eric Goldhagen, for example, even they see the difference. Because with Germany, it was, a complete destruction of European civilization, a return to pre-ancient times, times before antiquity, total barbarism. Right. While Bolshevism, as Eric Goldhagen put it, was a heresy inside the Enlightenment movement. So they were different, but there is some sense in this theory of totalitarianism. Is where I agree with it is that methods tell you a lot about ideology. Sometimes they tell you more than their programs. Mm-hmm. The methods of the modern ultra-liberal, jihadi liberalism, these people deliberately put us in the dark about their name because that sort of facilitates their actions. Mm-hmm. The monster is invincible if you don't name it, right? So these people, you're absolutely right, they use extremist nationalists when they can be handy, like in Ukraine. Or, for example, they used creations against the Serbs and the Bosnian Muslims against the Orthodox Serbs in Bosnia. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting how modern liberalism is blind to nationalism or even the extremist forms of nationalism where it suits its agenda, in places like Bosnia, Kosovo, or in Ukraine.
Right.
The other interesting trick that this new ideology uses is that it labels its opponents either left-wing totalitarians like Stalinists.
Right.
They even call Putin a Stalinist, although nothing could be further from the truth. It labels, for example, those Germans who oppose their government's policy in the Middle East, it labels them Islamophobes,
right,
which they are not. Because the worst form of Islamophobia was actually to intervene and support the armed rebellion in Syria or in Iraq.
Yep.
So indeed, this ideology is using the other two totalitarian ideologies for its own aims.
Right.
But there is nothing very new about it because, for example, the German Nazis, they used, for example, Slovak nationalism when they needed it against the Czechs and right. against the Poles.
Right.
The Slovaks were kind of allies. They used Italian fascism in the to their own names. So it's not entirely new. It's very hypocritical, but it's not new.
Yeah, even going back to the 40s, they used fascism in Greece. And they attempted to use it in Yugoslavia because you had had the in Croatia, you know, pretty strong ties to the actual Nazi party. Almost everywhere, that what they're doing with the jihadis also is the same thing. The ideological framework existed within liberalism, within this concept of, you know, the end of history, that, you know, liberalism isn't really an ideology, it's the ideology of non-ideologies, the ideology of freedom. And so mm-hmm. there's room to accommodate, particularly with, you know, the concept of identity politics, there's room to accommodate all of these other apparently contradictory ideologies and to basically, again, commodify them and weaponize them.
You're absolutely right. The problem with this new form of totalitarian liberalism, ultra-liberalism, whatever you call it, some people might call it also neoconservatism because it sometimes employs the people like Donald Rumsfeld for its own aims, who normally doesn't call himself a liberal. The problem is that it has the intolerance of a religion, you know, without calling itself a religion. If you look at the methods of modern ultra-liberalism, they have a sort of trinity, you know, just like Christians had their trinity. The ultra-liberals believe in what they call market economy, rule of law, or which means basically courts, and elections.
Right.
But if you look at the real situation, just like with aggressive Christians, extremist Christians, like with the Inquisition, you actually see the opposite of what they promise in the places where they win. I mean, the Western economy is highly monopolized, right?
Highly. Historically unprecedented concentration.
Yes, including the media. Unfortunately, it is trying to force this monopoly on other countries with catastrophic consequences for the countries like, for example, Senegal. You know, Senegal has about 80% of its economy internationalized, like working for the exports. And it is a tremendously poor country. I'm talking about Senegal because I visited it recently, because the whole concept of globalism being good for the poor, it turned out a huge hoax. Globalism in its modern form, pushed by the ultra-liberals, is a very radical form of monopolization of economy.
Right.
TTIP and TPP, if they are realized, they will lead to the complete victory of these monopolies. And that's why even the EU, which is normally very subservient to the United States and where this neoliberal ideology is even perhaps stronger than in the United States, even the EU is opposing TTIP because it will lead to total monopolization of the Western economy.
Yeah.
Talking about the rule of law, I mean, look, in Ukraine, you know, the EU wanted to impose sanctions before the Vilnius summit in 2013 and not to sign, you know, there were plans not to sign this European Association Agreement because one person was in jail, Yulia Tymoshenko.
Right.
And they said that although she's corrupt, but still she is a human being and we're concerned about her. Well, in 3 months, 9,000 people died.
Right.
Right. Hundreds were in jail officially. It's
right.
not the Russian press that reports it. It's the Ukrainian press that
right.
gives the names of the people who are put in jail
right.
for participating in what they call the illegal referendum in the East.
Right.
And the EU is silent about it. It pumps money into this news regime, gives it weapons.
Well, and not only that, you know, the main critique is coming from a country that incarcerates more people than the rest of the world, really.
Exactly. Or with the United States, with their prison population. So that's the kind of rule of law that they're supposed to propagate around the globe. Right. So just like with for example, Nazism, you know, Nazism was a tragic time for the German culture. Almost all of the meaningful writers emigrated. But still, the Nazis talked about German culture and its epics and other things like that. Right. In the same way, in the Soviet Union, they talked about freedom, you know, and rule of the people at the moment when you could not vote against the ruling regime because there were no alternative candidates. Right. You know, all the candidates were handpicked by the party. Right. So in the same way now you have liberalism talking about rule of law and supporting the regime in Ukraine, liberalism talking about market economy and monopolizing, for example, the media in the United States with six companies controlling everything.
Right.
And again, it's not new. It's a contradiction in terms. All of these extreme forms of ideologies, the extremist nationalism, extremist socialism in the Soviet Union, extremist liberalism, they all tend to be also very hypocritical. Mm. Like, for example, Stalin talked about the friendship of the peoples and proletarian solidarity, and we saw how that friendship of the peoples and proletarian solidarity worked in places like North Korea and China or in some of the East European countries. Right. So it's just hypocrisy everywhere. And unfortunately, I'm afraid that, of course, these new extremist form of liberalism, of course, it will disappear just like all the hideous utopias that we had in the 20th century. But before disappearing, it may take a lot of people's lives with it.
Yeah, maybe everyone's as they're tempting a war with Russia from NATO. The third leg is elections. And, case in point, the just recently almost concluded presidential election in the United States, where you have half the people not voting, and then out of the half that vote, a minority elects Donald Trump, but he becomes president because of the law here. And that's after a wall-to-wall campaign in the media against Trump, demonizing him, and also election laws that didn't allow Jill Stein and Gary Johnson to be involved in the debates. $1 billion worth of money, invisible money being allowed to be spent in the campaign and all of that. That's the third leg that it stands on, as opposed to President Putin, who enjoys something like a 70% favorability rate in Russia.
Despite the fact that his opponents had access to the media, the parliamentary campaign here, and in general, they have huge access to the media. 80% of the print press in Moscow is anti-Putin. But I would say that in this unholy trinity of ultra-liberalism, so-called rule of law, so-called elections, and so-called market economy, elections is the sphere where they fail to destroy everything. They destroy just about everything in the rule of law, but with the elections, there are still a lot of things to be done, and they promised to do it. I mean, if you look at the recent popular votes, the EU and the United States, the ultra-liberals actually lost all of them.
Right.
They lost the Brexit vote. They lost the vote in Holland on association of Ukraine with the EU. Yep. They lost what was supposed to be Hillary's election in the United States.
Right.
Their candidates, failed miserably in France, almost failed in Austria, failed in Italy.
Yep.
So they lose all of the elections, and their reaction, they don't change their own tactics.
Right.
Instead, they want to change elections. For example, with Germany, I mean, the tactic of saying that the election was hacked by the Russians, whatever that means.
Right.
It obviously didn't work in the United States, but they're using it again in Germany.
Yep.
In the same words, just the faces are different, but actually these are the people who had the special services in Germany pushing this conspiracy theory, just like the CIA and the other security agencies pushed it in the United States.
They're still pushing it. They're still pushing it here.
Exactly, and they're still pushing it. That's the most unpleasant thing. This is the problem with these totalitarian ideologies, including ultra-liberalism. They don't learn. I mean, if they fail somewhere, their response is to double down
right.
and to employ more resources.
Right.
And they never blame themselves for the defeat. They always blame some hideous foreigners or some bad officials, like with their failure in the United States, they failed the head of the FBI because he said something about Clinton, having to be responsible for her emails. In France, they blamed it on Sarkozy that he was bad. In Italy, they immediately abandoned the prime minister, even though the project of constitutional reform that he suggested was basically approved and pushed by the European Union. So this is one of the bad things about these radical forms of the three main ideologies of the 20th century. Their leaders don't learn. Usually they just double down on their previous policies.
And finally, you know, all of that bears on the immediate situation. You know, the anti-Russian propaganda here, you know, it seems to me to be an attempt to lay the groundwork in the population to prepare for war with Russia or, in any event, some sort of a face down. And you spoke in your article about hearing Thatcher say something that ran counter to a Marxist analysis that was prevalent in the Soviet Union and elsewhere. That was looking back even at World War One, that looked at war as an outgrowth of class conflict, that you had bourgeoisies in each country that were fighting over resources around the world, and so democracies, quote unquote, would go to war against each other. And Thatcher said there was no precedent in history when one democracy would attack another, and that attracted you and 95% of your classmates in high school. And yet, that's kind of what we're looking at right now, although each side has a critique of whether or not there's a democracy in the other.
Well, the problem is that democracy is a tricky thing. Mm. Exactly at the moment when you say, oh, we have democracy, and everyone around you starts saying it and speaking about the privilege of living in this or that country, usually it's the first sign that democracy is actually gone.
Because
democracy is a quest. It's a state of not being quite happy with your current government, with your current institutions, questioning the actions of your government sometimes, you know. So there is very little of it right now in the European Union, and there is very little of it in the United States. So indeed, I'm very concerned about democracy there. And Mrs. Thatcher, when she said that, probably she meant the post-war period. Post-war period. But the post-war period was kind of strange because it basically Europe became a paradise because it was enjoying the military support of the United States. The economic situation was improved by the fact that so many people died in the World War II, so that Malthusian theory suddenly became a reality without special government decisions.
Right.
So I think that this period of post-war European history was very deceptive. We are now re-entering history, unfortunately, and look how actually fragile and how aggressive sometimes how intolerant some of the European countries are.
Thank you.
This should not come as a big surprise to us if we look at the previous history of Europe before the World War II and during the World War II.
Thank you very much, Dmitry Babich. A pleasure as always.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.